The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Kristen Hadid. Kristen is the founder and CEO of Student Made, a cleaning company that hires students. She spends much of her time helping organizations across the country improve their own workplace culture. She's got a new book. It's called Permission to Screw Up, How I Learned to Lead by Doing Almost Everything Wrong. Kristen Hadid, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Second City developed this collaboration with Lyric Opera Chicago, and one of our programs involved teaching opera students to improvise. And one of the things that all the students mentioned was that in their world, it is perfection or failure. And in improvisation, failing is not only like permitted, it's encouraged. And I thought of this in the foreword to your book when you write, quote, pushing people to be perfect all the time, as in ballet, I guess, or opera, comes at a cost. In business, that cost is performance, innovation, and stability. Talk to us about that.
Well, I think, you know, in business, we've made it so that screwing up doesn't have a place at work.
Right.
And what that means is that when people are afraid to mess up, they don't ask for help when they need it. They cover up errors instead of reporting them and figuring out a way to do things better in the future. So really what it does is it ends up hurting the organization because we know that people are messing up. This idea of perfection is impossible.
Right.
And I think what's ironic is when you, as a leader, can say to your people, I don't have the answers, when you can encourage them to speak up when they don't have the answers, when you can talk about your screw-up, encourage them to bring their failures to the forefront, to talk about them, you actually build trust. Because a leader who acts as if they know all the answers, they have everything going perfectly, we don't trust that person because we know it's impossible to be perfect.
Yeah. So this is very important because I think, you know, people assume that the higher the stakes are, the more you have to scrub out the failures, when in fact, it's exactly the opposite. What happens in the Army, what happens on aircraft carriers, and all these situations is they practice failing over and over and over again because they recognize that human error is inevitable. And so what you try to do is prepare for as many ways that you can potentially fail so that you don't in the crucial times. And you've written a business book that is essentially a litany of all the times you screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it was hard to write, you know, because I think as a leader, you're programmed to make people feel safe and secure. And so the thinking is, well, in order to do that, I must act like I have it all together and that I've never really made a mistake, because if I admit that, will people want to follow me? Will they trust me? And so to write a book where I'm literally airing my dirty laundry, you know, I was definitely worried, what will people think of me? But the response has been, thank you for being honest, because we all make these mistakes. And I think I wrote the book because I want us to talk about that more.
So you have a great sort of origin story, and it runs through the book, and it's called The 45. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic, like, huge failure story. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I had just started the business. And I was 21, I think, at the time, and I had this contract to clean hundreds and hundreds of empty apartments. I didn't have any leadership experience, and definitely no experience running a business. But I hired 60 students to help me with this work. And so, you know, you can imagine the work is really gross. We're cleaning empty college apartments.
Ugh.
I didn't know to do any kind of training. So it was a mess already. But then I didn't know what my role was as the leader. So while my team is they're cleaning these apartments, I decided to sit in this air-conditioned clubhouse, and not because I thought I was better than them, but I truly just didn't know what my role was. And in every movie I'd ever seen about business, the boss kind of sits in the office and people just go to the office if they need the boss. So that's what I did, that in this clubhouse.
Right.
And that a boss who doesn't seem to care about you at all, combined with work that isn't fun, they just didn't want to do it anymore. So a couple days into the contract, 45 of the 60 people walked into that clubhouse where I was eating lunch, and they just quit on the spot. And it was awful. I mean, I was 21, and these were my peers. But looking back, I realized that that was the moment for me that everything really changed, because it made me obsessed with learning how to be a better leader.
And I love the way, I mean, you got them back, most of them, right?
I did. And that is kind of the funny part. I needed them, because we had so many apartments to clean. And I wish I could say I wanted to get them back, you know, to make it right. But really, just panic set in, and I had to get them back. And so I decided to have a meeting at my house, and I told everyone if they showed up, I would give them their paycheck early.
Mm-hmm.
And these were Brooke College students, so I knew that would, you know, I knew the paycheck thing would get everyone there, and it did.
Yeah.
But then I didn't know what to say to them, and so, because I didn't know what I had done wrong. So I just was honest. I said, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, and I essentially admitted my failure, but it wasn't intentional. And that was what made them want to come back, because they saw me as a human being and somebody who they really wanted to help.
Yeah. So you and I have a slightly similar story, because I started leading Second City when I was 26 with no training whatsoever in anything. Prior to that, I had been the director of sales, actually a position I invented at Second City. And I remember this distinctly because the lesson I had was I booked a group that came to the show, and they had like the worst time, soup to nuts. Every experience was bad, from the box office. There were spilled drinks. There was like, the show wasn't good that night, the whole thing. And I remember talking to this client who was just like really upset with me. And I'm like, I was trying to draw on the, like, what can I do to make this right? And so I said to them, I go, here's what I'm going to do to try to make this right, because I don't want to lose you as a client. You have free tickets for life to all your groups that you want to bring until you're ready to pay me, that we've shown you that we've done a good job. And the woman's like, okay, let me think about that. And she ended up booking a group, and they had a good time. And basically on the third visit back, she started paying again. And I think it is that thing when you say, you know, like there is power in saying you're sorry and you don't know what you're doing and you want to try.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So one of the things I also want to talk to you about, because you've got a really cool section on feedback, and I know, you know, everyone struggles with feedback. Even people who are good at it struggle with feedback. And Kim Scott wrote this terrific book called Radical Candor. And you mentioned this as well, that you got to be careful of solely being a cheerleader.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So what do you...
Yeah,
go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I think I became the head cheerleader in my company and told everyone how great they were all the time, because when the 45 people walked out on me, I was so afraid of people leaving again, and it really traumatized me. And also I knew the work wasn't fun, you know, working toilets. It's not fun. People don't wake up every day excited to clean toilets. So I thought I had to be the reason that people came to work, and that meant I had to make them feel good all the time. So I just went into this extreme head cheerleader mode.
But and honestly, like, you're not saying like don't cheerlead, but then there's this other side that you've got to do, and that took you some time to figure out, right? This idea of how do you give real time feedback even if it's negative.
Right. Well, you know, I would praise people just for showing up on time. I would praise people even if they did a bad job. If I walked in and the kitchen wasn't swept well, I would say, awesome job, and then as soon as they turn around, I'd be there sweeping the kitchen. And not only is that not sustainable, I learned that as a leader, you can't tell people they're great all the time, even if they're not. You know, your job is also to tell them where they could be better, and you're actually doing them a disservice when you don't do that. It's hard to look at somebody and say, you let me down, or you could have swept the kitchen a little more thoroughly. But if we don't tell them, we're basically communicating that whatever they're doing is acceptable by not addressing it. And I was the person who would give feedback from behind the computer. You know, I would mm-hmm. send it in an email completely sugar-coated, and I was just afraid. I was afraid that they wouldn't like me. I was afraid they wouldn't want to work at my company anymore. But I went to this course years later called Listen Like a Leader, and it's a course put on by a wonderful company named Mary Way Miller. Amazing. I highly recommend it. they talk about feedback, and they taught us this way to give it that's very comfortable and productive, and it's called an FBI. And each letter stands for something. So it's feeling, behavior, impact. And the idea is that if you communicate each of those three things, the person is really inspired to change their behavior. So you could say something like, if someone was late, you could say, John, I felt disappointed this morning when you were 30 minutes late to the meeting. And the impact of that is now I'm unsure if I can rely on you. And then you could say something like, and I don't want to feel that way, so can you help me? And the idea is that John didn't wake up wanting to be late to work, and he didn't wake up wanting to disappoint you. And so when he knows this, he will do everything in his power to change it so that he doesn't have that impact again. And when I started giving the FBI, I realized that the people around me were growing and that this was my job. My job was to really help the people around me be the best they could be and also teach them how to give feedback. So I brought that FBI back to the company and taught everyone in the business how to also use it so that they could give me feedback, because I think that's important too, empowering your people to come to you and say what you could do better.
Yeah, the speaking truth to power thing is difficult because people don't speak honestly to their bosses across the board. And what you have to do is, this is an interesting thing because it does come out of the sort of behavioral science community, which is words matter and the way you say things matter. And you talk about the sort of shit sandwich feedback method, which people do. And I certainly started doing that, where you say something nice, say your negative thing, and then say something nice. That doesn't work. You've already tripped off the sort of fear button. And in the sort of science community, you know, when you can welcome someone into the conversation as opposed to sort of making them an other, that, of course, is one way. There's also sort of the spaces you design. You talked about sitting behind your computer. I learned when I was doing performance reviews to literally get out and be on the same level in a chair that was the same size. Because I know I've been in those situations where, oh, my God, this person who is giving me feedback is literally higher up than me, signaling a sort of a status thing that's not good, gets you in your fear brain. So you really, it's about behaviors, words, but it's also about sort of designing the space in which you're having the conversation.
Absolutely. We love to go for a walk. That's what we do at Student Made. When we want to talk, we just go for a walk. And I think also what's important, I learned later too, that when it comes to recognition, you're not supposed to recognize people just for doing their job. Mm-hmm. You know, your job as a leader is actually to help people understand what their contributions are and what they do differently than other people and what their strengths are. And so you have to be specific with your recognition and find the things they do that go above and beyond and that are unique, because that's how you help people find what they're really good at. And when you say you're awesome and you're great and you give this generic praise over and over, it ends up losing its value and it doesn't mean much to the person. So it's actually better, I've learned, to give less recognition if it's more specific, intentional, and really thoughtful, because that means it means a lot more to people.
The journey in the book is really interesting too around this stuff, because I read so many business books and I don't see this kind of attention, which is the fact that feedback for specific employees changes the longer they're there as well. And this ties back to some science that we've talked about with our colleagues at the University of Chicago, which is primarily novices really do require some cheerleading. That's really important. But as they progress more and more, they need to be challenged. And you had people who were with your company for a long time who ended up leaving, or, you know, you had to say goodbye to, and you had to recognize too that your leadership style needed to change with them as they grew the company.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I think with feedback, number one, it builds trust, because people, when you can say to somebody, here's what I think, you know, you let down, they know you're shooting straight with them. And so I think the worst is when you're not getting feedback, you're wondering, am I doing great? Am I
right,
not?
Right.
What are they telling me? But then, yeah, as I grew the company, eventually I realized, you know, I'm trying everything I can and I'm giving this person all the feedback I can, and it's just not working. And that was one of the hardest lessons for me to learn, is when is it time to say goodbye to somebody? Because I'm the kind of person that believes in everyone. I believe in everyone's potential. And if somebody left the company, or if they, you know, I decided they had to leave the company, that to me was my failure, because I should have held on to them. I should have made it work. And I had to eventually realize, no, we both have a responsibility here. We both have to invest in the time here. And if I'm the only one doing the investing, if I'm the only one caring, I can't make this other person care, then it's time to walk away.
Yeah. One of the gifts and it wouldn't seem like a gift, that I know I received at Second City is that the shelf life of the talent at Second City is usually around 4 years before they really kind of have to move to New York or L.A. To try to get into the film and television business. So you are constantly saying goodbye to, like, incredible talent. So Tina Fey had to leave. Amy Poehler had to leave. Seth Meyers had to leave. You know, all these people I worked with. And it sucks, right? Because you're losing talent. But what it also does is makes room. It makes room for the next sort of great person. And then you sort of like you treat it less as a loss and more as a sort of natural evolution of talent inside your industry.
Absolutely. And my student made my company. We only hire students, and they range from students in high school to students who are in cosmetology school. I mean, it doesn't, you know, all different programs, and the point is to give a job that works around their classes, but we actually require that they leave when they graduate, because student made is kind of the stepping stone. It's a job where we really teach these skills that are required for success, we think, things like FBI, and we focus on relationship building and things that are important that you might not be learning in your classes, and then we say goodbye, and it's really hard because we invest so much time and energy into these people. And usually we don't even see the fruit of our labor there. It's they grow when they leave us.
Right.
And so we kind of follow them from afar, and we watch them achieve amazing things. It feels really good, but it's always sad to say goodbye.
Yep. All right, can we talk about millennials?
Yeah.
The dreaded millennial conversation that happens so frequently. All right, you have a quote in your book where you say, 4 out of 10 parents are involved in their child's job search, doing everything from sending resumes and cover letters on behalf of their children to attending the interview itself.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Has that happened to you?
Yeah, so, you know, well, most of our team members are millennials. And I think, I just want to say first that I don't think we can paint everyone with the same brush. Of course, there are people who fit the stereotypes to a T, and then people who do not at all. But yes, we've had parents coming into our office asking to apply for a job on for their child, asking to be a part of the interview. We've had parents call and request time off to tell us if my son or my daughter can't work tonight. And I think millennials were brought up in this time where parents were told to tell us we're great at everything. It was a self-esteem movement. You know, we can have anything we dream of, and to really be there for us. And I think as parents, you love your children and you want to give them more than you had, but what this over-involvement and over-helping does is it really hurts us, because now we're on our own, we're starting our first real job, and we kind of don't know how to think for ourselves. So we've had students ask us for things like, where can I get a stamp? Because when I do one, my mom mails me one. And I'm like, what? That takes forever. You wait for your mom to mail you a stamp? There's a faster way, you know? So we have to work really hard to train our students to think for themselves and to teach them how to be independent and self-reliant. And a big part of how we do that is by forcing them to fail, because I think that's how you build confidence. When you have somebody who's constantly protecting you and kind of keeping you in bubble wrap, you never really fall down. But it's only when you fall down and you get yourself back up that you look back and say, I did that and I can do it again. And that's what confidence is.
Right. And I am fiercely not anti-millennial. That's who I work with as well. And I think when we're talking about the criticism here, I'm talking about my generation. I'm talking about Gen X parents, right? So I have a 20-year-old and a 15-year-old. And one of the things, the benefits, they have two parents who grew up in improvisation, is that, you know, we let them fail over and over and over again, because if you don't know how to solve problems, you are not going to survive in the world, especially the world we're entering into.
Right. And just think about, I mean, let's say you didn't have helicopter parents. Well, technology is there to do everything for us. I mean, you have a question, you just ask Siri, or you type it in Google. You need directions, type it in. It tells you exactly where to go. And, I mean, there are apps now that kids are using in elementary school where they can take a picture of their homework, and it just texts back the answer, and it shows all the work. So they're just copying what it says in this app. So I think the point is that there are easy way outs everywhere. You know, we can have something else do the thinking for us. So that's why it's really important for parents to not be that easy way out, because we really have to learn how to think for ourselves, or it's very hard when we get into our first job, and then we're so petrified of failure. So what can happen is we are handed this project and we're really excited, but now all of a sudden we don't know what the next steps are. It's something we can Google. We'll call mom and dad to help us with. and we don't want to mess it up. So it's almost like we're just frozen. You know, we don't know the first step to take.
Yep. When I was reading your book, I kept, my wife was in the room, we're both reading, and I kept like being like, oh, listen, Ann, listen to this. This is, and this is remind you of a Second City story. So you have a section around being a gatekeeper of your culture. And I, it reminded me, we were doing a show in Denver with this wonderful theater company, and we were creating an original show about like Denver in the world of that city in Colorado. And we had this whole scene about a certain beer company who had a somewhat homophobic history. It was a great scene. It was terrific. And I got a call from the producer there saying, hey, that beer company is the sponsor of your show. And I'm like, okay, are you telling me we have to take the scene out? And he's like, I don't know what I'm telling you. I'm saying this could be an issue. And I went to our owner, and this was like a not insignificant amount of money. It was a very significant amount of money. And I said, hey, what's your instinct on this? I know what mine is. And he goes, well, I bet they're aligned, which is we'll walk away. You know, we're not going to do the show if they're going to make us take out the material. Turns out I kind of went back and said this, and he's like, okay, let me figure it out on this end. And we were able to leave the scene in and stay, which is a great ending to that story. But you've had that situation too, where you really, sometimes you have to turn down the money.
Yeah. We it's really hard. You know, we have this, then it's move out season, it's in the summer, and it's when everyone moves out and there's such a high demand for our services. We would go from maybe 75 people to 500 people, which means that we aren't as particular who gets hired. It ended up being, in the end, this scramble to get anyone with a pulse hired. All of a sudden, we aren't following our values. We're hiring people who maybe we wouldn't even feel comfortable with in our own homes because these are empty apartments, and we sort of justified it like, this is a separate business, only a 3-week busy season, and then all these people are you know, done with the work. And no, it was awful. Everyone dreaded the summer. Take your best people, and you're putting them with people who aren't following the values at all. And even I dreaded the summer. So eventually, it took me so much longer than it should have, but I just woke up one day and I said, why are we doing this to ourselves? It was really hard. It's our most profitable season, but we decided not to do the work, not to commit to this crazy volume because it really compromised our culture, and that was a bigger cost to us than, you know, looking at the money that we were bringing in.
And that had to pay off down the line, I would think, in terms of, you know, other things that are important in a business. I mean, because like, you know, money's great, but I mean, money doesn't make you happy. I mean, look around today, right? In the news, I mean, like the rich people are clearly miserable. They're doing terrible things to each other. You know, we build this community. We build, and you talk about compassionate workplaces. And I'm excited about this podcast because our talk is going to follow an interview I did recently with Jane Dutton and Monica Warline, who have written a book called Compassionate Workplaces. And you have this really, I really was struck by this, where I think it was you were doing a talk and talked about like, if your dog dies at work, you know, sitting with someone and like some guy in the audience like takes umbrage with that, and you're like, come on, man. And literally, that happened to me. My dog died, and I swear to God, the owner and the owner's wife of the company both came and like, you need to take, if you want to take time off, I get it. Like, I will sit and cry with you, you know, because it was important. And it's crazy that people don't think that you can be human at work.
Yeah. Yeah, this guy, I was talking about compassion at work and how it's important, and we have to create the space for people to talk about what's going on in their lives. And this guy goes, so if someone's dog dies, I'm just supposed to talk about it and cry with them? And I'm like, are you serious? And the whole point is that we're human, and if there's something going on in our life, we can't just drop it off at the front door, walk to the office, pretend like everything's great, do our work, and then just pick up that thing when we leave. It's coming with us, and it's affecting us, and actually, it's hurting the organization if it's on our mind, and because we're not getting our work done, you know, or we're distracted. So it's actually better to create a place where people can talk about that, which means the leader has to talk about it. The leader has to be able to come in and say, this is going on in my life, and I'm having a bad day, because when you do that, you make other people feel safe to talk about it. And it's not about, I joke, like, it's not of having a therapy session. It's not like everyone's sitting around crying every day. It's just if something is going on, talk about it so that the team, we can figure out how to reallocate the work so the work gets done and this person's taken care of. And when you do that, it's a ripple effect. People treat one another better. They treat the customer with compassion. It sort of just spills over. So, yeah, I'm a big believer. Compassion belongs at work. Empathy, vulnerability, all of that.
Right, because the key here is you have to acknowledge that people suffer at work. We all are human beings, and we have things happen to us, and it's not like we can turn off the suffering when we pull into our parking space. In fact, it's probably more stressful because we have to get through this work. And if you can simply acknowledge that people are suffering, sometimes that's the compassionate move, just to sort of say to someone, I see you, and I acknowledge what you're going through. That we're cool here. Be able to do what you're going to do to get yourself through the day. And I don't see many workplaces, unfortunately, that are comfortable with acknowledging that level of suffering on an individual level.
Right. And I think if there's one thing to do to keep people, it's that. That's what the people remember. I remember when I was having a bad day and you put your arm around me and we talked about it. I remember when, those are the moments that if your actions are saying, I care about you and you are more important to me than the work getting done and this, and that's why people will stay with a company. It's also why they'll leave a company if that isn't there and they're going through something and the company is there for them. The message you're sending is, I don't care about you. You're just a number to me. You're just here to produce. And that can make somebody want to move on and find an organization that cares about them.
I'm curious, in terms of the course of writing the book, when did you figure out the zag as opposed to the zig, that really, if you came from a place of, let's look at the failures and the mistakes as the opening to the knowledge that was that on your mind when you went into this, or did that reveal itself in the horrific world of writing a book?
I was so lost when I started writing. At first I started writing about millennials, threw it all away, because I realized everything I was talking about applies to all human beings, not just millennials. Then I started talking about success, everything that we had done and the success that we'd had, and it felt empty. And I actually went to dinner with a friend who's written several bestsellers, and I was just telling him how I was feeling about the book. And he said something to me that really changed the course of the book. He said, I think you're writing the right book when it's really hard to write. And the book I was writing wasn't hard to write at all. It was easy because it was just about success. And that made me think, and I started to go down this path of, how did I learn these lessons? How did I achieve X, Y, Z? And really it was a failure. And now I understand why people don't write about that, because it causes you to tell stories that don't paint yourself in the best light, to share things that maybe are embarrassing that you still feel guilty about, that you wish could take back and put that out there for the world to see. But I wish I would have found that kind of book when I started, because I was failing left and right and I felt alone, and all these books were wonderful and I learned so much from them, but it was like, here's how I started the business and now here's all the success we've had and here's what you should do. And it felt like there's something missing. How did you get from here to here? And really it's failure, but it's hard for people to talk about.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that's a cultural thing that exists certainly in this country and others I know as well. We are scared of failure. We're scared of appearing vulnerable in any way. And especially, I think, when you're a young leader, that's you're even more, because this is the other thing, and I'm sure, I don't know if you say it in the book, but I'm sure you feel it, which is, we all have imposter syndrome. None of us are thinking like, oh yeah, no, I've totally got this. I don't know any leader. If I do know a leader who's like that, that person is probably a terrible leader.
Right.
So
totally. So yeah. And what do we teach people? Fake it till you make it. I mean, I've heard that so many times. So it's like, when you're faking it till you make it, then all of a sudden it's not comfortable to talk about when you're failing. So I think as a society, we have to be better about making screwing up comfortable. I mean, we talk about, and that it's not something to fear. It's something that, also when we talk about it, and when we can see somebody who's achieved success say, here's actually how I got here. I messed up a lot. It makes leadership more attainable, because I think when you have this young person who is really wants to step up, but then they're looking around and they're like, all these people seem perfect. I must not be cut out for this, you know, and that's so sad. So I think we have to talk about our failures more to make leadership more attainable for the next generation too.
Absolutely. All right. The way we end this podcast every week is we ask our guest for a yes and story. So the idea here is an improvisation. When you have groups of people making something out of nothing, you can't do that by saying no. And if you say yes, but that's really passive aggressive. You have to say yes and. And I'm wondering if in your life, either, you know, personal or in work, you have a yes and story for us.
So many. We actually try to say yes and at work. I'm the worst. I have to remind myself. But there's a story that I guess it would kind of tie into this. So I got invited to this conference, and I didn't have any information other than to be in Aspen for 3 days. It was an invitation by a friend of mine that I know and trust. There wasn't any other, there weren't details. It just said, trust me to come. And I knew he wasn't a serial killer, so I decided to go. So I land, and there are name tags to sign in for this conference, and I'm looking at these name tags, and they're people who I don't belong in some room with. It's like the CFO of JetBlue, and mm-hmm. the person who founded the Container Store, and the former president of Ecuador, and I'm like, okay, am I here to clean everybody's rooms, or what? You know, why am I mm-hmm. here? And my friend comes over to me, and he says, you're the speaker. And I said, excuse me? And he said, you're the speaker. I need you to talk about millennials and the, you know, the obstacles that they face. And I never talked about that before, and I really wanted to say, you know, but I can, and all these things, say yes, and I did it. And the publisher of my book was in the audience, and I found out later that he intentionally invited me to speak so that this, you know, student-made story would be shared, because he really believed in what we were doing. And I think it's just an example that you just have to go with it. You have to be open. You have to go with the flow. You know, step outside your comfort zone, and that's when the most amazing things can happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a similar experience with the Aspen Ideas Festival. We got asked to go speak there, and I didn't know much about it, and I didn't like really look into it. And then you get there, and you're like, oh, Arianna Huffington is in the audience.
Yeah.
Walter Isaacson is here. Oh, Senator Mark Warner is in the front row.
Yeah.
And you just have to like get out of your fear brain, do your thing, warts and all. And quite frankly, when you do that, that's better than anything that's really canned, because these guys are used to hearing the sort of canned expert stuff. They want to know sort of what's happening at the level of someone who is maybe not so elevated or thinks of themselves in an elevated way.
Absolutely.
I love your yes and story. Kristen Hadid, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed this.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.